Welcome to the Wicked Writers Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Dubinsky. What makes someone a wicked writer? On this podcast, you'll hear from writers who have something to say with a little New England twist. Wicked Writers is your outlet for lifting up your voice and expressing your most creative self. Whether you write for fun or professionally or don't know where to start in your writing journey, Wicked Writers is here for you. I hope you enjoy the conversation and stay wicked. I am here with Jennifer Dupuy. She just came out with her debut novel, The Little French Bridal Shop. It was published by St. Martin's on March 9th, 2021. And just a little bit of background about Jennifer. She's a graduate of Brown University. She received honors in creative writing. She is an active member of the Grub Street writing community in Boston and has published in the feminist press. She was a semi-finalist for the 2016 James Jones First Novel Competition and a semi-finalist for the 2016 Faulkner Wisdom Competition. And super cool, we'll definitely be talking about this with her book, but she lives in a historic house just outside of Boston and is already working on her next two novels. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel. I'm super excited to be here.
I'm very excited to have you. As I have told my family, this is the first book I really have enjoyed in a very long time and really felt that it touched on a lot of themes, you know, young women who are searching for that identity and in this kind of marriage vortex or dating vortex. Tell us a little bit about what drove you to write The Little French Bridal Shop.
Writing for me often starts with image or setting. And in this case, kind of two images or settings. So I grew up north of Boston near, and my grandmother lived for many years in the seaside town of Beverly Farms, which is right next door to Manchester of, you know, Manchester by the Sea movie fame. And it's a little seaside community. And it was one I really drew on as I embarked on the opening pages, the novel. And I had this vision of sort of a house up on the hill, sort of a regal house. And there are some regal houses there. Beverly Farms at one point was sort of a place where the Boston Bronx, and so Bostonians who had settled in the Back Bay went to their summer houses there. And so I had a vision of this house, but I didn't quite know the story yet. And my husband and I had just started dating, and I learned that he had a love for historic houses as well as I did. So I had always had a love for houses. And we used to walk down nearby Elmhurst Road to admire a historic house there. And because we admired it so much and sort of imagined being there and living there, I named the house in my novel Elmhurst in tribute to that house on Elmhurst Road. And then flash forward a few months, and I had gifted myself a writing retreat, a writing weekend in Rockport, Massachusetts, also a really small North Shore town. And I was sitting in the Emerson Inn there, just about to embark on some writing, but I found myself being totally distracted by the large repeating pattern of pheasants in the wallpaper. And I couldn't stop laughing when I looked at them, and I couldn't stop looking at them. And so I began to write the pheasants into the wallpaper, into the story rather. And indeed, one of the first scenes I wrote was when my main character takes a crowbar to the wallpaper. She's a bit of an emotional mess. She's just lost her job and her boyfriend, and she's struggling with her mother's failing health. And so we see her in that moment. And I'll just mention that as the story progresses, she wanders into the local bridal shop, even though she has no groom, and she purchases a dress. And people assume all over town that she's getting married. And rather than do anything to dispel the rumor, she instead perpetuates it.
I hear you on that one. I pass a lot of bridal shops and I'm always like, why do you have to be engaged to go in there? They're such beautiful dresses.
And she sort of wanders in thinking, oh, I'll just try them on for fun. And then a whole bunch of assumptions are made, and it's sort of a live omission where she doesn't correct the assumptions that are made. And the shopkeeper says, oh, you must be getting married. And there's a ring on her finger. And the shopkeeper says, oh, he has beautiful taste, and it's not an engagement ring, but you know, so she buys the dress, and then assumptions are made.
So I'd love for you to go a little bit more into, like you were saying, assumptions are made and we have the choice whether we want to correct them or not. And could you just talk a little bit more how this comes into play for Larissa, the main character, and how that influenced your writing from your own experience?
Yes. You know, so she leaves the shop having bought a dress, and she sort of, and she knows there's no returns, right? So she's stuck with this dress, and she sort of thinks, well, it doesn't matter, you know, I'll get married someday. But then, you know, she gets a call soon from the local florist who says, you know, who she knows. And he says, well, I heard you were getting married and you didn't even bother to tell me. And she sort of is caught in the moment, and she thinks, well, you know, I was going to tell you. She gets caught up in this lie, and that type of thing keeps happening where she perpetuates it. As I said earlier, she's really not herself. And the reason she's not herself is that she's avoiding her mother's failing health, which is just really challenging for her to face. And this was a state that I recognized because I felt similarly disoriented when I was struggling with my mother's own failing health. She was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 22, and then unfortunately died from it 18 months later when I had just turned 24. And I wanted to really channel those feelings of kind of loss and confusion that consumes a child, even an adult child, a parent. And I wanted to get at what it was like to care for a parent and how the role reversal can really seem so severe. And so, you know, you're used to really kind of obeying your parents, respecting your parents, you know, most of us are. And it's funny to have to sort of challenge them in certain moments and be put in circumstances where you're, you know, you're caring for them in sometimes somewhat extreme or just troubling ways. So that's, to me, was the heart of the story and what I was trying to get at.
And on this podcast, we talk a lot about writing as a healing mechanism. And how did writing this book help you heal from your own experience with your mother?
Well, that's a great question. Yeah, you know, I'm in my 40s now, and she died when I was 24, so quite some time has passed. But on the other hand, the loss of someone that close to you creates a gap and a hole, and it's a hole that you can't fill, you know, and you don't intend to fill it because there isn't anyone else who can fill it, right? And so you kind of keep that hole almost as a symbol or a remembrance of that person. That said, it had been some time since I had sort of explored those feelings. And when she was sick, I was so busy trying to be practical and functional and, you know, going to the doctor's appointments. And my parents are divorced and I had just graduated from college. So I was one of the main caretakers and my stance was, I can handle this. I can do this. You know, so I was quite different, in fact, from Larissa in the book. But I did find it manifested in different ways. So in Larissa's case, it manifests as kind of really wacky, deceptive behavior. In my case, I found that my body was almost manifesting it. So, you know, I sprained my ankle. I got bronchitis twice, once in the middle of the summer when, you know, I pulled my back out. Like, so there were ways in which it was really manifesting. And then, you know, even years later, so, you know, people who have experienced loss like this will recognize, you know, when there are milestone events or sort of new events, like the birth of my daughter or when I got married or, you know, even birthdays or anniversaries of her death, it's challenging. So this book did really help me in a healing way. Process some of those emotions and filter them. You know, in the book, Larissa's in denial for quite some time, but then eventually she does face her mother's illness and realizes there's healing and hope in that. And, you know, I will say that though the book deals with some challenging subjects, it's ultimately a hopeful book. You know, I think readers will come away with it feeling that there's a sense of redemption and healing when we face our vulnerabilities and connect with those we love.
I would also say that there's a big theme about when you're faced with difficult circumstances, it's about the stories you tell, and it became less important over time if those stories were true or not. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I know that's true. So Larissa has a certain narrative in her head, both about sort of where her life is going and kind of the pretend wedding narrative. But she also has this narrative about her mother's illness and what that means. And her narrative in the beginning is, it's too hard, it's too difficult, I can't face it. And she comes around to realizing, no, actually, I can face it. And that doesn't mean it won't be hard, doesn't mean it won't be sad. But there's connection and there's love and there's actually strength in kind of feeling those emotions and admitting to those emotions.
And I would say there is also, you know, another layer, because disease that you chose for her mother was dementia. So that has a lot to do with memory. So I really, you know, loved the scenes where Larissa and her father were trying to create this new reality for her mother. And I found that very inspiring because, like you said, it's weird to be put in the position of caretaker of the parent when they've always taken care of you.
Right. Yeah, no, I love those scenes as well. So I realized that as the novel went on, Larissa was really losing herself. And of course, the person who's experiencing dementia experiences a loss of self. But I was exploring the loss of the daughter, the loss of self as experienced by the daughter. And so dementia seemed like a great way to amplify that theme of identity. But as I began to research dementia, I realized that many, many people who have experienced caretaking voice that, you know, the dementia affects your short-term memory. And so it's confusing sometimes for people who are taking care of dementia patients who don't have a background because they think, well, she can remember way back to childhood, but she doesn't remember that we just had lunch, you know, 30 seconds ago, right? And it's because it affects your short-term memory. And because of that, the advice that, you know, or the what people learn is that it's easier to sometimes go with the person who's suffering from dementia to go with their narrative rather than fight kind of the situation. So it's almost becomes like a game of improv where, you know, in improv, right, you know, if you kind of argue with the circumstances, you kill the scene, right? So you need to go with what the person is expressing. And the other piece of that is that with dementia, if you're getting angry with them, if you're saying, you know, no, mom, it's not time to go to the grocery store. We just went earlier today. And she's saying, but we didn't go. No, we did go. Yes, we did go. Like that creates kind of all kinds of negative feelings and friction. And if you just kind of respond with positive feelings and sort of go with the improv of the moment and sort of subtly change the subject so that you're onto something new, the person who's suffering will remember the positive feelings. And that's what you want to leave them with. And it creates a whole lot more joy and sense of safety.
I love how you broke down the nuances there, and it seems like you put a lot of, you know, thought, time, energy into doing your research and really thought about the characters and the structure of the book. Could you talk a little bit more about what went into that process, how long it took, you know, where did you get stuck?
Yeah, you know, so I did do a fair amount of research on Alzheimer's and dementia. And initially, when I wrote the book, I had characterized the mother's illness as definitely Alzheimer's. Whereas now, in the current iteration of it, the published book, it's actually called dementia, and it's sort of a more general dementia. And the reason for that is that, one, as I mentioned earlier, I felt like the story I wanted to tell was about Larissa's struggle with her identity as a result of her mother's dementia. And so I didn't want the spotlight to be shown too heavily on Alzheimer's. It felt like a little bit too weighted to refer to it that way. But then also I didn't feel like an expert. So that was a stumbling block. So even though I did do a fair amount of research and I read lots of books and talked with people who had experience, I still didn't feel like I was expert enough. I didn't have direct experience to be able to portray, you know, kind of full on on Alzheimer's. But I did want to get at this sort of way that dementia affected both the mother and the daughter.
So who were some of your writing influences?
Oh gosh, that's a big question. Yeah, so I love Ann Patchett. I love a writer named Andrew Sean Greer. I still love many of the classics like Charlotte Bronte and, you know, even Charles Dickens. I there's something about those kind of old style writers that I love. There's a writer named Carol Maso who's very descriptive. I'm sure I'm missing people. You know, I love quirky writers like Tom Perrotta, Richard Russo, people who sometimes have sort of funny narratives. Anne Tyler, for instance, will have that. Audrey Niffenegger.
Yeah, this gets to the ultimate question of why do you write?
Yeah, you know, I've always written, you know, from a very young age, I learned to read. And, you know, I mean, literally my kindergarten report card said, Jennifer doesn't want to talk to anybody. She just wants to sit in the corner and read. And let me tell you, that's still true. Sometimes, most days, I would really love to sit in the corner and read. So I was a very introverted child. I loved to read. And that evolved almost seamlessly into a love of writing. So again, my report cards as a kid, you know, Jennifer has the flair for creative writing. She should be encouraged to continue that. So at a young age, it just was that I loved the sound and the feel of, you know, I loved language, you know, I loved putting words together. to convey a feeling or a description. And I still love that. I'm a very descriptive writer. But in addition, now that I've gotten older and I can sort of think a little bit more heavily about the purpose of writing, I think stories are so central to our development and evolution as humans. And they have such an ability to connect us. And stories are paradigms for how we should act in real life. And so if we can read a story and imagine ourselves to be in the predicament that a protagonist or even a secondary character is in, we can learn those lessons with those characters. And we can apply those lessons to situations in our own life. We can learn empathy. We can learn how to let go. We can learn how to face difficult truths. And I think the role of stories in our lives is tremendous.
So tell us how the reception of Little French Bridal Shop, 10 days out from release, how it's going.
You know, it's going great. I had a really great launch at Belmont Books here in Belmont, Massachusetts. If you care to take a look at that, it's up on YouTube. I was in conversation with a wonderful author and friend named Marjan Kamali. She's written wonderful books. So that was fantastic. I've also had a number of podcast interviews like this one, and those have been super fun. It's been tough publishing during this time because of the pandemic, of course. And I was disappointed at first that I wouldn't be able to meet, friends and fans and family in person. But I'm really just inspired by how the writing and reading community has risen to the challenge. All of these bookstores have learned how to have online events, and they've gotten quite fluent at it. And actually having a Zoom event, my sister who lives in Seattle can join, and people who are near and far can join and join from the comfort of their own homes. So it's been really fun and exciting. And also just, seeing my book in the window of my local bookstore, that kind of just made it for me.
You touched a little bit about the writing community. Were you part of writing groups as you were working on this book? What did your routine?
Yeah, so I'm a longstanding member of the Grub Street writing community in Boston. They're a local writing organization that organizes conferences, weekend workshops, and longer, 6 to 10 week classes. And they are phenomenal. I've been a member of them since, I think, 2002 or 2003. And they've just been instrumental in kind of creating a support system and helping me build my craft and helping me meet other writers. So they're phenomenal. And I met my writing group there. So I meet with three wonderful women who are also all published authors. They are Crystal King, Anjali Mitter-Duva, and Henriette Lazaridis. And we used to meet in person. So we used to meet, we'd have drinks and food and catch up. And we definitely missed that part. And then we'd talk about writing and critique each other's work. And now we just meet over Zoom. So we try to meet every 2 to 3 weeks and somebody submits something ahead of time. And then we critique it and give our feedback. So they've been awesome and just a wonderful support throughout the writing of the book, but also throughout the publication process.
So, this podcast also reaches people who are at the beginning of their writing career. So what advice do you have for people who are just starting out?
I think you have to realize it takes time. So you need to know that this is something that likely will not happen overnight. You need to be persistent. You need to kind of motivate yourself on a daily basis. That said, you kind of can't go around it. You have to go through it. So what I mean by that is just putting in the time. You may have sort of a natural proclivity towards writing, and that's great, but there's always ways in which you can hone your craft. And so the only way you can hone your craft is by writing, and that takes time and effort. So write, keep at it. And then, but also don't be too hard on yourself on your first drafts. There are many, many ways to write a novel, and everybody writes it differently. You need to tap into the way that works for you. So get your first draft out. Try not to be too nitpicky. The purpose of the first draft is to kind of learn what you're writing about and who your characters are and what their world is. And then you can go back and revise and fine tune. I know many of you out there are time constrained, as am I. I work full time. I have kids. I have a husband. I have a household to help maintain. And so my approach, I've said this a lot lately, is a sort of brick by brick, bead by bead approach, try to familiarize yourself with your writing every day. Even if you're not writing a page or a sentence, I mean, a page would be great, but if you're not, you're reading it. So then when you're driving to work or when you're, you know, grocery shopping or picking up the kids or whatever, it's on your brain, and you'll be surprised by how often something will pop into your head that will solve a problem that you're having with your draft or your writing. And you'll think, oh, that's what I need to do. So just familiarize yourself with it. Try to do a little bit every day, and that will be progress.
Great. And any hints about what the next two novels are about?
Yeah. So one's still sort of in the gestation phase. I'm kind of carving it out. So I'm not going to talk about that one, although I am working on it. I am thinking about it. In gestation phase, I love to take lots of kind of notes, often by freehand, with images and phrases and even sometimes just words. I'll think like, that's a great word that would fit in this book. The other one that I'm working on is about a young girl. It's told from a first person perspective of a 17-year-old girl, and her mother and father are pregnant with her sister, and a strange man arrives at the foot of the driveway to announce that he might be the father of that baby. So,
well, we'll have to read it to see how it winds up. But where can people buy your debut novel, get in touch with you, give us the works?
I am at jenniferdupuy.com. That's my website. And you'll see the landing page there has many ways in which you can purchase the book. So I love to buy locally, but there's also, you know, places like Amazon and Bookshop and other such places. And I'm also on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and my handles are there. I'd love to connect with you.
Great. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Definitely encourage everyone to go buy The Little French Bridal Shop from a local shop if you can. And again, you know, thank you for your wisdom, your time, and your energy.
Thank you so much, Rachel. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you for listening, Wicked Writers, or Wicketeers, as some may call themselves. You can find out more information about the podcast at www.wickedwriters.org. You can visit us on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. You can look up Wicked Writers. I'm also on Threadless selling some merch, and hope that you like the show enough to buy some merch. And that's wickedwriters.threadless.com, as well as we have a newsletter. I try and keep it weekly or bi-weekly, trying to not flood your inboxes, but sometimes I can't help it. And the website for the newsletter is wickedwriters.substack.com. And as always, feel free to email me at hello@wickedwriters.org. Stay wicked.